Poetry Foundation's Essential American Poets podcast. Essential American Poets is an online audio poetry collection. The poets in the collection were selected in 2006 by Donald Hall when he was Poet Laureate. Recordings of the poets he selected are available online at poetryfoundation.org and poetryarchive.org. In this edition of the podcast, we'll hear poems by Anthony Hecht. Anthony Hecht was born in 1923 in New York City. As a young man, Hecht knew nothing of poetry, but when he went away to Bard College, he fell deeply in love with literature. When he announced to his alarmed parents that he planned to become a poet, they asked a friend to talk him out of it. But that friend was Theodore Geisel, better known as Dr. Seuss, and the talk only renewed Hecht's dedication to the craft. Hecht graduated from college in 1944 and was immediately drafted into the infantry and sent to Europe. Hecht was seared by his experiences there. His division liberated the Flossenbürg concentration camp in Bavaria. Since he spoke a little French, Hecht took the testimonies of the prisoners who survived. The trauma stayed with him. For years after, he said, I would wake up screaming. After the war, Hecht truly began his career as a poet. He went to Kenyon College on the GI Bill and studied under the poet John Crow Ransom. Afterward, he taught for a short time at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, then traveled to New York and Rome, where he met the poets Alan Tate and W.H. Auden. In 1967, Hecht published The Hard Hours, a volume of poetry which addressed his time in World War II, and which won him the Pulitzer. Over the ensuing years, Hecht published half a dozen books, and also published literary criticism and translations of the Greek playwright Aeschylus. Hecht's poetry explores themes of love, war, the Holocaust, classical history, and mythology. He was also considered a master of form. Hecht has won many awards, including a Guggenheim Fellowship, the Bollingen Prize, the Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize, and the Tanning Award for Lifetime Achievement. Anthony Hecht died in October of 2004 in New York City. Just 1 month later, he received the National Medal of the Arts. The poems you are about to hear were recorded at Harvard University in 1971.
I should explain that I'm a native New Yorker, and that Third Avenue is not only conspicuously crowded with bars, even today, but was so many years ago when there was an elevated train that ran the length of the avenue. This L was particularly useful because it cast a very comfortable gloom over the whole avenue, and when you came out of a bar, you didn't have to face the raw sunlight instantly, but could work by graduated steps back to the world of the living. Third Avenue in sunlight, nature's error. Already the bars are filled, and John is there. Beneath a plentiful lady over the mirror, he tilts his glass in the mild mahogany air. I think of him when he first got out of college. Serious, thin, unlikely to succeed. For several months he hung around the village, boldly t-shirted, unfettered, but unfreed. Now he confides to a stranger, I was first scout and kept my glimmers peeled till after dark. Our outfit had as its sign a bloody knout. We met behind the museum in Central Park. Of course, we were kids. But still those savages, war-painted, a flap of leather at the loins, file silently against him. Hostages are never taken. One summer in Des Moines, they entered his hotel room, tomahawks flashing like barracuda. He tried to pray. 3 years of treatment. Occasionally he talks about how he almost didn't get away. Daily, the prowling sunlight whets its knife along the sidewalk. We almost never meet. In the Rembrandt dark, he lifts his amber life. My bar is somewhat further down the street. This poem contrasts two executions. The details of the first were conflated by me and were taken from details of several executions that took place in England in the Renaissance. They include Bishops Latimer and Ridley, but there are others too. And the second is described as accurately as I could do it from a book written by a man who survived 5 years in the Buchenwald concentration camp during the Second World War. The title of the poem, More Light, More Light, these words are reputed to be Goethe's last words. No one knows exactly what he intended to mean by them, and he may have meant something very innocent and unimportant indeed. But those who admire German culture and enlightenment like to believe that he was referring to something of that sort. His presence in the poem is an obscure and very slight one, but is important because prisoners who were sent to Buchenwald by train, as most of them were, got off at the nearest railroad station, which was Weimar, the great Goethe shrine, and had to march the rest of the way to the camp. More light, more light. Composed in the tower before his execution, these moving verses, and being brought at that time painfully to the stake, submitted, declaring thus, I implore my God to witness that I have made no crime. Nor was he forsaken of courage, but the death was horrible, the sack of gunpowder failing to ignite. His legs were blistered sticks on which the black sap bubbled and burst as he howled for the kindly light. And that was but one, and by no means one of the worst. Permitted at least his pitiful dignity, and such as were by made prayers in the name of Christ that shall judge all men for his soul's tranquility. We move now to outside a German wood. Three men are there commanded to dig a hole in which the two Jews are ordered to lie down and be buried alive by the third, who is a Pole. Not light from the shrine at Weimar beyond the hill, nor light from heaven appeared. But he did refuse. A Luger settled back deeply in its glove. He was ordered to change places with the Jews. Much casual death had drained away their souls. The thick dirt mounted toward the quivering chin. When only the head was exposed, the order came to dig him out again and to get back in. No light, no light in the blue Polish eye. When he finished, a riding boot packed down the earth. The Luger hovered lightly in its glove. He was shot in the belly and in 3 hours bled to death. No prayers or incense rose up in those hours, which grew to be years, and every day came mute ghosts from the ovens sifting through crisp air and settled upon his eyes in a black soot. A poem in which one word perhaps needs comment. Childermass is that ceremony which celebrates the massacre of the innocents. The poem takes its title from Hamlet's instructions to the players not to wave their arms around too much. It out Herod's Herod, pray you, avoid it. Tonight, my children hunch toward their western and are glad as with a Sunday punch, the good casts out the bad. And in their fairy tales, the warty giant and witch get sealed in doorless jails, and the match girl strikes it rich. I've made myself a drink. The giant and witch are set to bust out of the clink when my children have gone to bed. All frequencies are loud with signals of despair. In flash and morse, they crowd the rondure of the air. For the wicked have grown strong. Their numbers mock at death. Their cow brings forth its young. Their bull engendereth. They're very fond of strength. Satan bestrides the globe. He stalks its breadth and length and finds out even Job. Yet by quite other laws my children make their case. Half God, half Santa Claus, but with my voice and face. A hero comes to save the poor man, beggar man, thief, and make the world behave and put an end to grief. And that their sleep be sound, I say this Childermas, who could not at one time have saved them from the gas. A poem which takes its title from the British philosopher Gilbert Ryle, who I understand coined the phrase "the ghost in the machine." This is a poem called "The Ghost in the Martini." Over the rim of the glass, containing a good martini with a twist, I eye her bosom and consider a pass, certain we'd not be missed in the general hubbub. Her lips, which I forgot to say are superb, never stop babbling once. Aye, there's the rub. But who would want to curb such delicious, artful flattery? It seems she adores my work, the distinguished grey of my hair. I muse on the salt and battery of the sexual clinch and say something terse and gruff about the marked disparity in our ages. She looks like 23, though eager enough. As for the famous wages of sin, she can't have attained even to union scale, though you never can tell. Her waist is slender and suggestively chained, and things are going well. The martini does its job, God bless it, seeping down to the dark old id. Is there no cradle, sir, you would not rob, says ego, but the lid is off. The word is strike while the iron's hot. And now, ingenuous and gay, she is asking me about what I was like at 20. 20, eh? You wouldn't have liked me then, I answer, looking carefully into her eyes. I was shy, withdrawn, awkward, one of those men that girls seemed to despise, moody and self-obsessed, unhappy, defiant, with guilty dreams galore, full of ill-natured pride, an unconfessed snob and a thorough bore. Her smile is meant to convey how changed or modest I am, I can't tell which, when I suddenly hear someone close to me say, "You lousy son of a bitch." A young man's voice, by the sound, coming, it seems, from the twist in the martini. "You arrogant, elderly lech, you broken-down brother of ape-neck Sweeney. Thought I was buried for good under 6 thick feet of mindless self-regard? Dance on my grave, would you, you galliard stud, Silenus in leotard? Well, summon me you did, and I come unwillingly, like Samuel's ghost. All things shall be revealed that have been hid, there's something for you to toast. You only got where you are by standing upon my ectoplasmic shoulders, and wherever that is may not be so high or far in the eyes of some beholders. Take, for example, me. I have sat alone in the dark, accomplishing little, and worth no more to myself in pride and fee than a cup of lukewarm spittle, but honest about it withal. Withal, forsooth. Please not to interrupt. And the lovelies went by, the long and the short and the tall, hankered for, but untapped. Bloody monastic it was, a neurotic mixture of self-denial and fear, the verse halting, the cataleptic pause, no sensible pain, no tear, but an interior drip as from an ulcer, where in the humid, deep center of myself I would scratch and grip the wet walls of the keep, or lie on my back and smell from the corners the sharp ammoniac urine stink. No light, but rather darkness visible, and plenty of time to think. In that thick fetid air I talk to myself in giddy recitative. I have been studying how I may compare this prison where I live unto the world. I learned little and was awarded no degrees. Yet all that sunken hideousness earned your negligence and ease. Nor was it wholly sick, having procured you a certain modest fame, a devotion rather, a grim device to stick to something I could not name. Meanwhile, she babbles on about men or whatever, and the juniper juice shuts up at last, having sung, I trust, like a swan, still given to self-abuse. Better get out of here. If he opens his trap again, it could get much worse. I touch her elbow and, leaning toward her ear, tell her to find her purse.
That was Anthony Hecht, recorded at Harvard University in 1971 and used by permission of Alfred A. Knopf, a division of Random House. You have been listening to the Essential American Poets podcast, produced by the Poetry Foundation in collaboration with poetryarchive.org. To learn more about Anthony Hecht and other Essential American Poets, and to hear more poetry, go to poetryfoundation.org.